Keyhole, hosted by Karen Dolan. I'm Richard Dolan, Karen's husband, and guest hosting for today's show, as every so often my lovely wife is inclined to let me do. For myself, I've been involved in the area of UFO research and other various subterranean topics since the 1990s. As a reformed academician, that is, someone who left the university world at that time, I now consider myself liberated to study the many areas considered just not done within that environment. Certainly UFOs are right up on that list, just as most kinds of conspiracies, I guess, let's say, JFK, and of course the current Big Daddy conspiracy, 9/11. Hey, and it's only in the last couple of years that academicians even discussed the possibility that Roosevelt and Marshall knew something about Pearl Harbor in advance. It only took them 50 years to broach that one, right? So all of that provides a little bit of introduction to what we're going to be discussing for the next 2 hours. Dr. Colleen Clements, a brilliant scholar who has been persecuted for her groundbreaking work in ancient culture, is the guest for today's show. For several decades, Colleen had taught philosophy at the Rochester Institute of Technology, and that is right here in Rochester, New York, where I live. In 2006, she published a book called The Order of the Dragon, a rather bold reinterpretation on the origins of human civilization. Unfortunately for Colleen, the book angered a number of people within her university, in particular conservative Christian elements, and the next thing she knew, she had been fired. Colleen Clements argues that we should take ancient writers at their word and suggests that early humans were not alone in the creation of our civilization. Now, this is a theme that can remind us of Zechariah Sitchin, although Colleen Clements approaches her topic very differently, working from academic and scientific sources to create what some have argued is the first true history of the culture that created modern civilization. And she calls this the Dragon Culture, which thrived prior to 35,000 B.C. in northern Eurasia. She then traces that culture through the ages, through Mesopotamia, Egypt, the Balkans, Languedoc, the Freemasons, and into the present. The Order of the Dragon is a fascinating book. I've read it. I was blown away by it. It deserves our attention, as does the horrible treatment of an excellent scholar by a hidebound academic establishment. Let me also say that Colleen and I have been friends for many years. And in fact, I would say that we form two-thirds of a kind of, let's say, Rochester, New York-based fringe troika. Maybe she could come up with a better name for it. Of scholarly people who, from time to time, discuss UFOs or ancient history or just the screwy nature of academia. And in fact, the third member, our good friend Dr. Bernie Angelo, has a PhD in philosophy. Bernie's writing his own book on UFOs, philosophy, and academia. And I suspect that he's going to make a very big splash with that one, and that should be out. That should be done soon. Last thing I want to mention is that, to my knowledge, this is Colleen's first interview on this topic. So we have something new here. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a real privilege for all of us to be able to talk to Colleen and to listen to what she has to say. So, Colleen, let me welcome you to Through the Keyhole.
Okay.
Are you excited to be on here?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Good. So let me just ask you, by way of background, how long did you teach at the Rochester Institute of Technology?
Well, I was an adjunct there because my primary appointment was at the University of Rochester Department of Psychiatry and the School of Medicine. That doesn't mean I'm as good as Belikovsky, but at least we had some things shared. My primary specialty at that point was bioethics. But at RIT, I taught for three departments, actually, for about 20 years until last summer when I was told that I was apparently incompetent and some rather nasty things were said about my book.
Yeah.
I'm not the only academic that that's ever happened to. In fact, there are far too many. I've been in some correspondence with Professor Norman Finkelstein who wrote two books on a rather delicate subject and was denied tenure by DePaul University, even though in the submission the committee said what a wonderful teacher he was. His student evaluations were all extremely high, and what an important scholar he was. And as a result of that, of course, he didn't get tenure.
Yeah.
And just recently, in the last couple of weeks, the last course he was to teach was taken away from him. So this is a common problem in academia. I don't feel alone in a sense, but I feel really sad that there are so many other people who are also experiencing the same thing.
I recall my early years in my 20s as a very motivated undergraduate and then graduate student. Particularly as an undergraduate, I had a very idealized view of academia as the kind of bastion of intellectual freedom, really to study the things that you could study there and nowhere else. And of course, as I got older, realized that, gee, this isn't exactly the way I had imagined it would be.
I had
to take off my rose-tinted glasses, so to speak.
Yeah.
And you found that even the harder way.
Yes. I mean, I've always been a bit of an outlier, even in bioethics. I've experienced some things early on in my career, which I didn't say anything about or do anything about, and found other ways to get my thoughts and hypotheses out and get published and continue to teach. So, I wasn't all that bold and brave in my early days either.
And we find it takes time with that.
Yeah.
But let me ask you, I'm going to cut right to the chase, and can you tell the listeners, what is the basic thesis of your book, The Order of the Dragon? What are you arguing?
Well, I'm arguing, and I'm violating apparently an academic commandment and a commandment that you might find, oddly enough, in the Centers for Inquiry in Buffalo, for example.
Referring to the headquarters of the Committee of Scientific Investigation.
Yes.
The PSYCOP.
Yes, it happens to be, and my late husband was a member almost all his life. But all of them share this commandment, thou shalt not take old texts and traditions literally. And what I did in The Order of the Dragon, and I'm doing in my second book, which is going to be called The White Island, is trying to take a look at scholarly research from a number of areas, from genetics, from archaeology, from history, astronomy, to try and reconstruct as best I can what this original, even maybe pre-dragon culture history was. And I've also tried to trace it geographically. And what I found is that the old texts are remarkably consistent on this and actually do conform to what we know in genetics from human migration or in archaeology from dates for various artifacts and from astronomy in terms of where the various constellations were at these time periods.
So what are these old texts saying?
Well, they all basically tell more or less the same story, which is what I found interesting. There are themes to this, to these texts, and trying to reconstruct them. Of course, one of the most important ones is that they stress the freedom to seek any experience and think about it. Free thinking is an important part of these old texts. They practiced what they preached in terms of religious and metaphysical tolerance. And the classic world, which derives this from, I believe, and I argue, from northern Eurasia, maintained that value of intolerance until the fall of the Roman Empire. And they also stressed something very early on, which we might call political liberty, that each man had the right to oppose, and that opposition could always consider that there was a right to reconciliation between the two parties.
So you're saying the ancient text you're looking at has almost argued a freedom code, in a sense, going way, way back, farther back than most ancient scholars. So what cultures are we talking about? How old are these texts? Where were these people living?
Well, I started out in the Order of the Dragon. I hadn't got quite as far as my research for the second book, but certainly in Central Eurasia. And we know from linguistic studies, we know from genetic analysis, that there was a population split somewhere in that northern area. My second book pushes it even further north than The Order of the Dragon does. But that this population split then introduced these values and these primary themes of this culture into what became the major civilizations of our world civilization.
Okay. These are long before, say, ancient Sumerian culture.
Well, yes, I think the Sumerians, oddly enough, I have a friend who's a Sumerian scholar, John Mayer, and he sometimes tells me some of the issues that those scholars are discussing. And there are two rather interesting ones. One is that they think there may be a link between one of the Sumerian Anunnaki called Enki and the writer, or at least the person the Book of Enoch was named after. Now, the Book of Enoch is also, to some extent, considered to have perhaps had an Indus civilization origin, and there are groups of Sumerian scholars who feel that because the Sumerians are not the aboriginal people of southern Iraq, they feel the Sumerians came down into Iraq, and most likely from India, so that Enki, in their terms, might originally have been an Indian god. That makes the Sumerians a little bit later, although their own history takes them back, their king list takes them back to about 250,000, but that really is prehistory, that's antediluvian.
Yeah. So what are the things that you're saying, though, that got so many of the other scholars angry with you? What was the basic argument or the basic thing that these ancient... taking the ancient texts literally, what are the things that they were saying that you're taking literally, that other scholars think is just, metaphorical?
I suspect, although I don't know if they could articulate it as well, I suspect some of the other themes, such as the fact that in the text, humans are portrayed as hybrids between some sky beings and the original Homo sapiens species. Now, that, in fact, has been confirmed within the last year by some excellent research out of the Max Planck Institute and the Howard Hughes Institute, and then published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Medicine.
Can you expand on that? In what way?
That we are a hybrid species. They suspect Neanderthal. We have a paternity issue here. And the question of, who is the father? Neanderthal is their most likely candidate, because that would be the only other hominid species that we know of that was contemporary with human beings. But the texts don't say that.
What do the texts say?
The texts say, in fact, that the sky beings, and this is a whole range of texts, from the official Bible, as Sitchin did point out with the Bene Ha'Elohim, although he's not the first one who considered the possibility of contact. In fact, Carl Sagan did as well, that these sky beings interbred with the human species to produce what we are at the moment, which is a hybrid species. Now, that philosophers apparently couldn't tolerate a suggestion like that.
That's a little bit beyond their standard viewpoint, I would say.
Well, the book was described as appalling and shocking. The other thing I think they didn't like was that almost every one of these texts, with maybe the exception of the Sumerian tablets we've found so far, talk about a battle with the dragon, so maybe that's a highly modified version. But the originals, if you go back to the Zendavesta and the Rig Vedas, talk very specifically about a civil war in space, followed by, because we apparently got dragged into this, a civil war on the planet. And that was a bit more than people could take either. But if you read the text literally, that is what they say.
The Rig Veda you're talking about.
Yeah, and even the Zendavesta, to the extent that Ahriman's forces fought with Ahura Mazda's forces in space.
This is the thing that really struck me about your book, incidentally, because, you know, reading The Order of the Dragon, it's impossible for anyone not to think at least somewhat about Zechariah Sitchin.
Mm-hmm.
Because your thesis, your themes are very similar, and yet
mm-hmm.
here's one of the differences I noticed, whereas Sitchin really focuses on the Sumerian texts,
mm-hmm.
I think really almost exclusively,
yeah.
And he really digs in.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Your approach is really a lot broader. I mean, you
mm-hmm.
I don't think you're afraid to deal with the Sumerian aspect, but
yeah.
I think your main interests are, as you mentioned, you discuss the Indian subcontinent and then
mm-hmm.
Eurasia and then other cultures as well. I know you're interested in Norse culture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I feel that there's a very strong complementary
yes.
aspect to what you're doing. But
yeah.
I also notice that in your book, I don't think you mentioned Zechariah Sitchin a single time.
No, I didn't.
No.
And
why did you not do that?
Well, there was a reason for not doing it. Well, maybe two. The general reason is that there is such suppression of any research in this area. If you ask, I think, the majority of college students names like Enki's, or they might know Krishna, but they probably don't know who the Asura were, and they probably haven't heard of the tripartite city. If you mention Yima, I think there'll be a blank. We haven't been educated to our root culture. It's really been taken away from us, in a sense, either
yeah.
through benign or malign neglect. And anyone who tries to do that, it tends to get suppressed. It seems like it's almost an inevitability. And my concern was, okay, one of the weapons they use in this suppression is to try to say this is a pseudoscience or it's pseudo-history, and sometimes even using the kook factor as a weapon. It's really unfair, and they shouldn't be doing this, but knowing that they're doing it, what I tried to do in the book was take only recognized academic authorities. For example, with the Sumerian, if you take some of the things that Samuel Noah Kramer writes about the Sumerians.
One of the most prominent scholars ever on Sumerian
yeah,
culture.
Yeah, and then my friend John Mayer, who's also an internationally known Sumerian scholar, wrote a wonderful book on Enki, which he loaned me because it's out of print at the moment. But I had those sources available, and rather than give the suppression an easy shot at me, I wanted to try to restrict it to journals of science, recognized people in their academic fields, and that unfortunately had to leave Sitchin out for the most part, because if you mention Sitchin to an academic, they simply dismiss it.
This is one of the many ironies about what you did. I mean, it seemed to me in reading your book, you bent over backwards to make it as academic and as scholarly and standard
mm-hmm.
as possible.
Yeah.
And yet, in fact, it didn't help because they still essentially blackballed you.
They figured out what I was doing.
Right. They said, yes, that guy, that whole, you know, crazy thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in a sense, and I just, it struck me as odd because you know, who, the question is who are you really writing this for? And obviously you're writing it for more of an academic audience.
Mm-hmm.
When, in fact, I think what you should do is just screw that whole world and write a really, really good bestseller for, you know, for everyone else, because the people who really care at this point, the academicians are.
Well,
they're a lost cause.
What I tried to do there is, okay, I'm going to write academic books, research this carefully, and
right.
I have my number two son, who's a lawyer historian, who's been up in Kazakhstan and Armenia and currently is in Ukraine,
intelligent, yes,
all over. I have had him as a kind of field help on this. So I wanted to get out a series of academic books, but I also am writing novels, in which I have a little more freedom, and so I'm doing two things at once. But this was meant to establish, okay, here we are. If you don't think humans are hybrids, then you're not a good geneticist. Now, they don't call it interbreeding for some reason. Geneticists are bashful. They call it introgression, but if you read their article, they admit it's the same thing. I wanted to get as much, I guess, on the record that academics couldn't knock down.
We're going to go to break in about 30 seconds.
Oh, that was that noise. Yes.
When we... Well, no, that was the noise of me just replugging in my earphone, which is...
Oh, rough. Okay.
We're going to go to break, though. When we come back, I would like to ask you to... Let's see if we can fill in the picture as clearly as possible of the story that it looks like. What does it look like,
okay,
ancient civilization? And, you know, what are the main sources that you're really working off of here,
okay,
as well?
All right.
Seems like we're going to go to break now. I hope our producers are online with all of that, because you're listening right now to Through the Keyhole. My name is Richard Dolan, your guest host for today. We are with Dr. Colleen Clements talking about the Order of the Dragon. This is just absolutely fascinating. We'll be back. Are back. You're listening to Through the Keyhole. I'm Richard Dolan, guest hosting for my dear wife, Karen Dolan. She'll be back next week. Don't worry. She's not going far for her many fans. And she gets more and more fans every week, incidentally. Just as an aside, for those of you who've listened to this show before, listened to my wife, I think what you find is that she is really an excellent interviewer. Karen is the kind of person who has very, very wide-ranging interests on a lot of out-there types of topics. She's very knowledgeable and has her own thoughts, but she's also civil and polite and gracious enough to just let other people say their piece, and she's great at that. And I think as a result, she's been developing some very loyal listeners. I'm very happy to know about that. But this week I'm here with Dr. Colleen Clements, PhD, who has written actually a number of very interesting books, and we can direct you to some of those in a moment. But the one we're talking about today is The Order of the Dragon. And Colleen, we're back. So before the break, I was asking if you could give us really two clear ideas. A, the primary sources that you feel are important for giving us a sense of this ancient history. And B, what can we get like a clear image of what this ancient history, in your opinion, was?
Okay. I've got a list of major themes, and my sources, well, let me just mention a few. Some of them are anthropological, such as the habit of people up on the Yamal Peninsula of making pyramid shapes out of sticks.
Okay, where is this?
The Yamal Peninsula. It's right on the Arctic Sea. In fact, in the area where Russia, Canada, the U.S., Denmark, Greenland are now disputing who owns the territory under the North Pole. There is a remnant. Yamal means one of a twin, and that represents in the themes of these texts the opposer. The word Satan, for example, is a generic name which means one who opposes. Loki is an opposer. The notion that there are these two energy forces in the cosmos, and they need to be kept in balance, like chaos theory or systems theory would advocate. There is a reconciliation between the two forces in the very old text. But that's one example, the anthropological study. There are some artifacts, archaeological, that I use from reports in various scientific journals. The discovery of an ivory statuette of a lion-headed man that's about 40,000 years old. And goes all the way down through history to the Mithra little figures that used to be worn in Rome around people's necks and has some connection still. There's an ivory carving of Orion, and there was the discovery of an ivory flute with a pentatonic scale, which is an Eastern scale, indicating that where these were found in Ulm, Germany, that some population had come across Siberia into the Scandinavian and Germanic areas, and that was probably one of the first migrations.
Anthropology, archaeology.
Archaeology, genetics, particularly the mtDNA research and the Y chromosome research, which puts one particular Y chromosome group, the Krishna group, up in India and probably Eurasia much earlier than people had expected. I think it's around 55,000 BC. And there really isn't an African Adam, so that's rather interesting too. You can trace migration patterns or where people were at a particular time using mtDNA research. So that gives you some indication of movement in a particular area. I use the historians and the old texts. And what I found is that people who take the old texts seriously really get the reality of it confirmed. For example, Pliny the Elder, when Vesuvius went off, wanted to describe the event. It wasn't anything he'd ever seen before, anybody'd seen before. And people read his writings as being exaggerated, as poetry, as myth, because what he was describing is what we now know as a pyroclastic flow from a volcano.
Okay.
And we just discovered that in the early part of the 20th century.
Interesting. And so what you're saying is that Pliny actually very accurately described this natural phenomenon, mm-hmm. and though for years and years, centuries, people thought that he was engaging in hype.
And the same thing for Homer.
Well, right, the great discovery of Troy by Heinrich von Schliemann in the 19th century. Here's a non-academician, very intelligent expert on Homeric, the Iliad and the Odyssey, who was convinced Troy existed. And listeners may not be aware that for centuries, scholars assumed that the Trojan War and all this stuff in Homeric writing was simply a myth. And Schliemann believed that there was this Troy, and he went out and found it. I mean, the most amazing discovery, really, of 19th century archaeology, perhaps.
Yeah, because he took it literally. And
exactly.
And it turns out he was right to do that.
Right.
And, I mean, there are lots of examples of that happening. So I use both history and archaeology and the texts themselves.
So which particular texts are you most drawn to in looking at this?
I like the Rig Vedas. I particularly like the Mahabharata as a story of a really tragic civil war, and I also like it for its connection. At the end of the Mahabharata, the incarnation of God, Vishnu, Krishna, is so depressed that he wants to leave the earth, so he goes into the forest and assumes a yoga position. At which point a hunter mistakes him for a deer and shoots him in the heel, killing him. Now, my immediate reaction when I ran across this was, my God, that's Achilles at Troy.
Exactly. And in both cases, they're killed by a shot to the heel, when you would actually wonder, the heel? Mm-hmm. Why would that be fatal?
Yeah.
It always struck me as odd about Achilles, and I did not know about this other account of Vishnu.
Yeah. So that it seems to me that some of you get layering as this culture goes through time and geographic location, and that makes it a little bit difficult because there's time compression and there are multiple layers pressed down on each other. But some of the story of Troy, the Achilles part, may actually go back to the ancestors of the Greeks, who were very likely the Eurasians who came down from India, because there was a connection with Dionysus and Heracles, who both may very well have been Indian demiurges or famous individuals, and were taken into Greek culture as this civilization moved.
May I ask you, regarding the Rig Vedas in particular, this is something that UFO researchers from time to time find themselves interested in as well. And I know, like, UFOs isn't really your main thing, although you're interested. But, I mean, for many years, a number of people looking at trying to understand ancient UFO phenomena have looked at the Rig Vedas, and continually you hear people talking about the Vimanas.
Yeah.
These are descriptions of what appear to be craft flown by the gods in the air in the course of a civil war with each other.
Yeah.
And if I'm not mistaken, in one description, the result of this war was that a certain river was poisoned for a long period of time, or the fish died. Or I'm not an expert in this, but this is what...
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, is this... Is this something that you're familiar with, and are you able to comment on that?
Yes, well, the texts about the White Island, which are found within the Mahabharata, it's another period before the Mahabharata, but they're told to the kings by the rishis, or the sages, the Brahmins. The White Island contains some very interesting ideas. And that could be interpreted in terms of our new understanding of space travel and the possibility of intelligent societies in other systems than our own. And it can't be ruled out. The probability is strong enough, I think, that it has to be maintained. Now, that doesn't mean it's proved.
Right. How would other scholars, conventional scholars, say, interpret this? I've often wondered.
Well, they think it's a bit of mythopoesis, and
just old ancient people making stuff up.
They spoke in poetry, and they had a different kind of mind than ours. The quality was different. They were more superstitious. They were more mystical. There are all sorts of assumptions, but if you trace that idea back, and unfortunately, most modern science has accepted that, but they don't know the real source of it. At the beginning of the Enlightenment, there was a philosopher historian. His name was Giambattista Vico.
Often considered the first great philosopher of history.
Well, I'm not sure about the great.
Well, that's what I learned millions of years ago in graduate school, Colleen.
He made, a blunder that was even worse than Nietzsche's. He proposed, based on basically his religious prejudice, he had no data for it. There was no evidence, there was no argument or logic, unless you assumed that the Judeo-Christian monotheism was far, far superior to this primitive classic culture that it had replaced. That was his working assumption. And he had that, in quotes, primitive culture eventually decline, get worse and worse and worse, whereas the Judeo-Christian one was moving toward the establishment of the New Jerusalem, which incidentally some of our founding fathers wanted to establish too. So he described these ancient texts and ancient civilizations as nasty terms, actually, as declining, as depraved, and one of the reasons for it was that their mind was different than the mind of modern man. It wasn't scientific, it was pre-scientific, it was inclined to be superstitious, and that that description has stuck with this ancient culture now for a very long time. So you have Enlightenment scientists who should have known better, because certainly Isaac Newton wouldn't have agreed with that.
Right.
You had scientists up to the present day who want to make a distinction between modern man, which started with the Enlightenment, I guess, or with Judeo-Christian monotheism, and ancient man. And so all of these writings are taken as I guess songs, poetry, myth. We can't really understand them. That was another thing that Vico proposed.
So really, when you think about it, I mean, the whole concept of ancient people as mythopoetic thinkers,
mm-hmm.
derived from an era in which we knew really almost next to nothing about society.
Right.
Everything that we knew or thought we knew back then was essentially based on the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that situation held really almost until about a century ago,
mm-hmm.
when we started making significant discoveries. I mean, the Sumerians were hardly known. An entire civilization, the Hittites, were completely unknown until about a century ago.
Yeah.
And so we're only just now really piecing it together. And mm-hmm. I think what you're suggesting is that it's taken a long time for our ideology, for our understanding to catch up with what we're now learning archaeologically.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the past is rising, although we try to destroy it as quickly as it rises. It's amazing to me that the Nag Hammadi Library survived, or that the Gospel of Judas survived. I don't know that it looks too good for the ossuaries that supposedly are the tombs of the family of Jesus.
Okay, well, now we've got about 8 or 9 minutes before we go to break, and before we do that, I'm wondering if you can, because you've given us a great, at least, understanding of how you're building your case.
Mm-hmm.
What is the case? I mean, you talked about hybridization,
mm-hmm.
so can you get a little more into it? What it looks like may have happened?
Somewhere,
and when it happened?
Okay, somewhere in northern Eurasia. They have the time pegged pretty well at about 37,000 B.C. Well, I shouldn't say pretty well, because it could go even back to 60,000 B.C. But
that's a long way.
At some time, a gene entered the human race that carried, it was a microcephalin gene, which is involved with brain growth and neural growth. And humans to that time had carried what they called the non-D allele. At that point, the D allele appeared just very suddenly. There was tremendous positive selection for it, so it's spread now over about, I believe, 70% of the world population. But again, primarily, with the exception of a couple places in South America and Central America, primarily in the northern hemisphere rather than the southern hemisphere. That indicated a rather significant event had occurred. And the fact that humans are hybrids, which is not just based on this, it's based on a lot of other data, that indicates that one of two possibilities are here. Either we and Neanderthal interbred, although Neanderthal never showed any increase in civilization or culture based on having such a gene, and we haven't found it yet in the sequencing, or that Homo sapiens may have interbred with a species that wasn't of this planet, which sounds extreme, and I know it sounds shocking, but I'm only...
Maybe not to people listening to this today.
Okay.
It'd be less shocking than you think, but okay.
Okay, so that gives you a good natural experiment. Either when we're finished sequencing Neanderthal, which will be in less than 2 years, we'll find that gene, or we won't find it.
But what you're saying is that the gene, did you call it the DLL gene?
No, it's the D allele. It's a form of the gene.
I'm sorry, I didn't. But this gene, this is not, in other words, a speculative statement. This is fact, what you're telling us.
Yeah. I'm just quoting from the proceedings of the National Academy
right.
of Science.
And so that what they've argued is that this gene appeared apparently out of nowhere around 37,000 B.C. or perhaps earlier.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they don't have an explanation for this.
Right.
Is that right?
Right.
And this is a gene associated with brain growth.
Mm-hmm.
And that
mm-hmm.
most of humanity, so you're saying some people don't have this?
Yeah. There is another gene.
This is a political nightmare. You realize. I mean,
well,
this is one
not,
of these...
It's not as bad as it sounds, at least for Northeast Africa, because there is a gene there that appeared, although I don't know that it was that early. So it's not racial. You have Asians who have this gene in high numbers. There are some parts where it's 100%. And you have this odd 100% frequency in a place like Brazil, too. So it isn't exactly related to racial as much as to geographic areas.
Okay, so it appeared, this is not open to scientific debate, at least at this point it seems like it's here, so then the real question is how and why.
Yeah.
You're suggesting that Neanderthals are not a logical candidate.
No, I don't think they are. I mean,
and really,
it
seems counterintuitive that they would be.
Yeah, because, you know, in empirical data sometimes surprises our best logic, and it could turn out that Neanderthal is the one.
But they were in the process of being wiped out at really exactly that time.
Yeah.
So you might hypothesize, I mean, I'm just making this up as I go, that that somehow a Neanderthal gene interacted with our own structure to create something special that hadn't existed within Neanderthal. I guess you could say maybe that could happen, but what you're suggesting, I think what a lot of people would probably agree with you listening to this, is that another source.
Yeah, they've ruled out genetic drift and they've ruled out spontaneous mutation, so that doesn't leave much. It's either going to be Neanderthal, or we have to go try to find another Homo erectus somewhere in Asia, or we may have to go off-planet. Now, all of those hypotheses, my argument is that you can't shut any of them off, and that they're all perfectly legitimate academically. But I find it interesting that they've occurred in northern Eurasia, and at about this time, I have to wait, like everybody else, for the Neanderthal gene to be fully sequenced so we can find out. But there are other differences genetically that we can find in northern Europeans or Eurasians, such as inverted gene sequences, which also had to come in from some other species. So that it's an interesting field, and it may confirm one of the primary themes of these old texts, that humans are not only hybrids, but that we were taught and we were brought along in our civilization by sky beings who may have had their own power politics agenda, but certainly it affected us.
These are themes in, as you point out, in just about every ancient culture one can think about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love studying ancient mythology. I have two very inquisitive children who are interested in this. So I've actually, in the last 5-6 years, really been reading a lot of ancient mythology with both of my children,
mm-hmm.
Having gone into the Norse myths, for example,
mm-hmm.
The Greek myths,
right.
The Hindu mythology, which is
mm-hmm.
fascinating. And they all really describe the gods, and it's always plural.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, creating us, teaching us, with the ancient Egyptians.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is going mm-hmm. way, way back.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just excited. And then the fact that the contemporary scientific research, I didn't realize this, by the way, that genetic research was pointing in this direction toward a new gene.
Now, the other thing is that we still have a country, Kazakhstan, that built a memorial to commemorate the notion that all of these texts actually go back to their root. So either the Kazakhs are all out of their minds, which they're not, my son was there for their last election, or they in fact still retain the memory and the transmission of this culture.
Well, I think for the next hour, we're about to go to break.
Okay.
So what I really want to get into is the dragon culture itself.
Okay.
Talk about Kazakhstan
mm-hmm.
and then see where that leads. And if we're able to take questions.
Okay, sure.
That's up to the producers. I don't have any power over
right.
that from where I am. But we'll see about that, too. So
yeah.
We're hitting the hour now.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we go to break? You are listening to Through the Keyhole Radio. I'm Richard Dolan. I'm here with the fascinating Colleen Clements, PhD, and we are talking about the Order of the Dragon and really attempting to piece together our true ancient history. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. are back. I'm Rich Dolan. You're listening to Through the Keyhole. The regular host of this fine show is my wife, my dear wife, Karen Dolan, who has been hosting this, I'm trying to think how long, a couple of months now. Every now and then, my wife will throw me a bone and say, here, you can host the show. And this is actually only the second one that I hosted, that I am hosting, excuse me. I'm here with my good friend Colleen Clements, right here in Rochester, New York. We are two-thirds of our Rochester club. If you can come up with a better name for what you, me, and Bernie are, by the way, Colleen, feel free. We were talking about her fascinating book, The Order of the Dragon. And we're going to keep going there. But before we go, Colleen, I wonder if, I know you have a website, and if you might be able to direct interested readers to your website. Before you answer, I will say to everyone listening that Colleen is a true scholar, not a self-promoter, and when you go to the site, you'll realize she hasn't updated it in a while. Is that right?
That's true, yeah.
Okay, but there's still good stuff on there.
Yeah, and it doesn't have, it's not interactive either. It doesn't have my email address. So.
Well, you got to do something and put that on there.
Yes.
People may want to email you.
Yeah.
But what is the website called?
The website is Clements eBooks.
That's Clements with a T, so it's
C-L-E-M-E-N-T-S-D-O-O-K-S.
Clements eBook. Books.
Books, yeah.
.com.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that has some information on Order of the Dragon, also some other books that you've written.
Yeah, yeah, but they're rough drafts, and as I said, it hasn't been updated in a bit.
you wrote another book dealing a fictional account of Lucifer, if I recall correctly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have two now in the Lucifer biography. Yes.
Your work has really just taken you. I don't know if you've intended to, you know, piss off the entire Christian community, but you've certainly done a good job of getting a lot of them angry with you.
Oh, well, I'm sorry, but they should read their texts. Some of the things we're saying are in Genesis, or
right.
Daniel talks about the Watchers, and the problem with the official version of the Bible is that it's been cut. It's almost a Reader's Digest version.
Yes.
The original literature was much more extensive.
I completely agree with you. Maybe we can even get into that before the end of this next hour.
Mm-hmm.
We were having a really, you're just giving us a fascinating story of our, what may be our true origins, and the addition of a new gene that really, what you've argued, has increased human intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
So can you continue with this story? What does it look like to you happened?
Okay.
And how did this whole thing continue through history, even to modern times?
Yeah. Now, there is a big unknown, which is the Civil War in space, although for Christian listeners, that also is even in the official Bible. What isn't is the detail that a third of the hierarchy of space sided with Lucifer, a third with Yahweh, and a third were neutral. The neutral angels show up in the Book of Enoch, for example, which should have been in the Bible. I don't think you can understand the Bible without reading the Book of Enoch. But anyway, that is still a big unknown, the Civil War in space. But starting with Yima, who was a northern Eurasian, somewhere in probably along the coast between Siberia and Finland. He was told to go south by his contacts with sky beings, who told him that a great ice and snow event was going to happen, and that he needed to build a vara, and he needed to bring the seeds of plants, animals, and humans.
Vara is a large ship, I assume?
Well, it's an enclosed space. It had artificial light, but it was a large, like a football stadium, but bigger, and it was completely enclosed, and it was self-sustaining. a little bit like some of our experiments, I guess.
So this is the Ark.
It is the Ark, except it wasn't a flood. It was probably an ice age event. And he chose the best seed of all of these various plants, animals, and humans, and took them there. From that point, there's a migration into Scandinavia, the Baltic, the Germanic peoples, and you begin to get the Norse writings, and you get Loki, for example, and Odin. Odin led that migration because in Norse mythology, he really wasn't a philosopher's god. He was a very powerful warrior who led his people west. Then you had the big split where some went into Iran and created the Persian culture, and some went across the Himalayas and into India and northwest China, where you get some pyramids and you get the worship of Mount Kailash, for example, as a pyramidal mountain, and you have a very strong pyramidal culture that came down from there. There you get from the Iranian, the Zendavestas, and Zurvanism. And from the Himalayas, you get the Rig Vedas. From the Himalayas, it's quite likely that the Sumerians arrived in the Mesopotamian area. And we don't know quite where the Egyptians came from. But then there was the introduction after the at the last stages of the Roman Empire, of the Abrahamic monotheisms. Islam, Christianity, and Judaism became powerful.
Right.
At that point, there still were people of this dragon culture.
And why do you call it, by the
way?
Why
do I
the
call
dragon
it dragon culture?
Culture,
yeah. Indus rock art and tablets often portray the constellation Draco. It's a polar constellation, and in 10,500 BC, it was the North Star, what the Egyptians called Thuban. That polar constellation was very important to them, and astronomy was very important to them. So I decided, since there also were names such as Pendragon and Dragon, since the text of the Passion of St. George that was found in Ethiopia talked about Dardanus, since Troy, in fact, was settled, and that Dardanus means dragon, since Troy was settled by the first king was Dardanus, a son of Zeus, and a hybrid, therefore.
All right.
And the people were called Dardanoi, and we still call that entrance
Straits of Dardanelles, right?
The Dardanelles, yeah.
Yeah.
That's all dragon. You get Armenia, the Church of Armenia, that has the two heads of a dragon on the staff of the patriarch of the church, and they've had that from the very beginning. They also have dragon stones. So I decided with that amount of focus on dragons and on fighting dragons or fighting with dragons that calling it the dragon culture instead of the northern Eurasian culture would be more fun. That was my the reason. But there are good reasons to do it in terms of how important this dragon symbol was and in terms of the fact that the seraphim, which are, if you think about it, sentient beings out there somewhere in space, they were described as being in the form of a dragon or being dragon-faced. At any rate, when we got to the point of the collapse of the Roman Empire in the West, and the Eastern Roman Empire in the East then controlling these areas, we got the rise or the reemergence of this dragon culture in the form, I think, of the Bogomils, of the Paulicians. We have Chrysocher trying to protect his people and establish them safely.
These are all very obscure.
I know. See, we don't know.
No one knows about these people anymore, right?
Right. We have we've been deprived of our roots, and it's so important to understand our roots.
Right.
I don't think we can be full human beings and happy and content unless we do, and yet our schools, our academic traditions have not given us our story.
Is it a case of Christian suppression, or is there something else going on here?
I think it's more than, because certainly Muslims are perfectly willing to do it too, and so are Orthodox Jews, and it may not just be the monotheism. There's certainly been repressions going on in Persia, the Hindus and the Muslims have been fighting with each other.
I wonder how much, when you think about the destruction of some of the ancient libraries, Alexandria comes to mind, but even Constantinople, I think 1204, the amount of knowledge that we could have had.
Oh, yes.
Oh, my dear God.
That
what
was
we
lost. When I was in Saudi Arabia a few years ago, I taught a philosophy, especially set up philosophy class for some of the young women there, and they were describing to me when the Mongols came in to their Saracenic civilization and the libraries, that they just threw all the books in the rivers, and the rivers were black with the ink from the pages. It was a great tragedy. But at any rate, these people, they soldiered on, and at great cost to themselves. They were burned alive. They were crucified. Eventually dispersed, sent as refugees into Eastern Europe, where they established a real live Church of the Dragon called the Ecclesia Draguntii.
When was this?
It probably in the 1300s, maybe even a little into the 1200s.
Not far removed from the establishment of, say, the Freemasons, or
maybe
the Order of the Templars.
Because there was a military arm of this culture called the Order of the Dragon, and there was a cultural or spiritual arm, the Ecclesia. And the Ecclesia Draguntii that was the mother church. But they were a very tolerant group because the various churches didn't agree with each other on doctrine, and they never cast any of them out. They just accepted this diversity and this tolerance as being something to be cherished. So even though the mother church and their version of the Pope came from the Ecclesia Draguntii, the Ecclesia Sclavonica, also, which disagreed, was just part of the group. It never got into these sectarian clashes. There was a real military order. The original Bosnian order, probably 1789, and it was formed to try to stop the Turks from coming into Bosnia and the Balkan area, and they assassinated the Sultan. They rode into the camp of the Turks and to the Sultan's tent. I think there were seven of them. One of them got out alive. The other they were killed, and they knew it was something of a suicide mission. Then King Sigismund of Hungary, who wanted to become the Holy Roman Empire emperor, he decided he'd reconstitute the order, although he knew it wasn't a Christian order. In 1408, you got the Order of the Dragon, and the cover of my book shows the pin, the actual pin that they were all given and they were supposed to wear on their person at all times. And
what I've got so many questions lining up here. Someone actually on the chat room that we have wanted to know. Now, you sort of did discuss the dragon symbology, but does a dragon symbol mean anything? You refer to the constellation Draco.
Right.
This person asks, why is it the oldest common symbol known to man?
Because I think it was at the root of this Eurasian culture, which is probably the oldest culture known to man. Now, why they felt it was that important, my research hasn't totally uncovered, but the dragon represented the void of space, I'm pretty sure, the deep. And it also represented change in a system. And it sometimes represented the opposer.
Fascinating.
So
Loki or Satan or that type
of
figure.
Oh, lots of them. I mean, Enki was an opposer, too. He and Enlil were always quarreling with each other. And so was Seth. And there's a whole list of, you know,
yeah,
different names.
Right, right.
Now, there is a Indus tablet with a drawing of an individual who's quite interesting because his hands go down below his knees, and that was one of the descriptions of the sky beings that the Hindu rishis brought back from White Island. And his name may be translated correctly, maybe not, is Amuvan, Lord of Space-Time, and establisher of the Draco constellation.
Wow.
I don't have enough data to do much with that yet, and we may never be able to recover that. But the dragon symbol and the symbol of the lion-headed man were two of the most important symbols, and they've both come down through time.
Yeah.
They haven't been lost. The Sphinx also was a symbol in northern Eurasia.
Uh-huh.
Along with these pyramids. At any rate, the ecclesia from ecclesiae, I guess I should say, from Bosnia, probably had some influence on the Cathars in southern France in the Languedoc, and that was a terrible genocide that was committed by the French king and the Catholic Pope against them. But they most likely are part of this tradition. The Templars picked it up, I think, from the Crusades. And if you read the Inquisition confessions, they really are confessing to worshiping the opposer. There's a good book by Yuri Stoyanov, a well-respected academic, called The Other God. And he talks about this dualism, that the two forces, again, these balanced forces.
So they were worshiping, not really worshiping Satan per se, you're
not
saying.
The Christian.
They were worshiping
yeah.
something much more ancient?
Oh, yes, yeah. And,
right.
And I mean, the idea of the devil or Satan, that's a Christian idea, and they're more than welcome to it because I don't want any part of it. It's pretty awful, a lot of scatology and torture, sadism, unbelievable ugliness. They're welcome to that.
So the Templars, though, became acquainted, you're saying, with the dragon culture.
Yeah, in most likelihood when they were on the Crusades, because they were very close to the Ismailis, and they were a sect close to the Sufi mystics in Islam. They still exist, actually. They're in India, and they're ruled by Aga Khans. I can't remember if it's Aga Khan the Fourth or whoever. But their ideas corresponded somewhat with the dualism of the Eurasians. I wonder
because the Templars, they were at the temple of Jerusalem,
mm-hmm.
and they were excavating. I mean, wasn't this the thing? I'd always assumed that the Templars found something very, very important underneath that temple.
They might have. It's hard to tell. The interesting thing about the Templars, we think of them as a military order, but in fact, they were the architects of the infrastructure of Europe. They and the Knights Hospitallers, between the two of them, they built all the public buildings, the cathedrals, the roads, the bridges of Europe.
Right.
And had a fair amount of freedom. They had their own precincts in which they were the law rather than the King of France. they collected.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, the taxes.
Which is why they, I assume, why they were destroyed, because they
oh,
were
yeah.
such a rival to the King of France.
Yeah, it was a state within a state.
Absolutely.
But I think the Templars' confession that they worshipped the opposer, and they called this being by its correct name, the opposer, I think that was a good indication that they were, in fact, involved in what the church would have called heresy, but which I prefer to call heterodoxy, as opposed to the orthodoxy. And they, despite their power, they were eventually destroyed. The military strategy didn't work. And I think, and Naudin makes a pretty good argument, that they moved into, in fact, they were an integral, very, very close connection with the Freemasons in their precincts. And so they probably slipped rather quietly into Freemasonry and into some of the other military orders in Spain and Portugal. And Freemasonry then, I think, carries this tradition.
Here's something
but garbled.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
Oh, that's okay. Unfortunately, it's been getting garbled as it passed along, and we really need to go back to the roots to try to see if we can get down to the basic structure of it rather than to these social and time accretions that are clinging on to it.
I wonder, do you think that the purveyors of the dragon culture, or the conveyors of it, people who continue to interact with it and learn from it, are they, how aware do you think that they would be of a kind of extraterrestrial
I don't think
origin?
They would.
they would just look at it as like the gods. Is that how they would see this, or would they be seeing non-human
I think,
ET coming down?
Well, they didn't have the experience we now have with space travel, so they would look at it in terms of polytheistic gods, but the philosophers and theologians' gods of monotheism, that's a very different thing. Philosophers
right.
tend to want to define just one god. They want to define it as, and they don't even want to call it, they want to call it him, which doesn't make any sense.
Yes, God is this big guy with a beard sitting on a throne somewhere.
But they want to define it as omnipotent, omniscient, and all good. And that doesn't make any sense from a philosophic point of view. You can't have those three things together easily and say that you have a meaningful concept. I don't think that was the concept that these individuals had. I think they saw it much more as the Hindu polytheists would see it, or as even the Sumerians, because these beings could be killed, and they could be damaged. You can see that in the Greek myths. During the Battle of Troy, Apollo was run through his stomach because he was fighting in the battle when he shouldn't have been, and some human ran him through. And he had to rush back up to Olympus to get healed.
Yeah, Ares and Aphrodite were also smacked around by Achaean warriors.
Oh, yeah. And then in Sumerian, you have Damazi, who was killed. In the Norse mythology, you have a lot of the Aesir who don't make it, especially during Ragnarok,
right.
And Loki himself is killed. So these were individuals who, rational beings, who had a very long lifespan but weren't completely protected. And that I think is closer to the concept than the philosopher's definition or the monotheist theologian's definition.
I've often felt that the ancient polytheistic beliefs really got shortchanged for the same reasons. Because when you really, if you're an ancient person, or even a modern person, trying to understand why things don't work out. They never work out. Let's face it.
Mm-hmm.
Who at age 50 is really living the dreams that they had hoped when they were 20?
Mm-hmm.
Just people die. Our bodies get old. Failure happens. Disappointments
mm-hmm.
happen.
Mm-hmm.
Unfair things happen to good people. And so
it's
not all that outrageous to understand the gods as somewhat fickle,
as
forces that need to be appeased, and you don't always appease them, and this is why bad things happen. And it's at least as logical as saying that God, you know, the Heavenly Father, he's omnipotent, but he can't control this Satan figure, or he chooses not to control Satan.
Well, it's an interesting,
right?
the Christian version of the devil is very different than the old text versions. Even the Judaic version is not
like in the book of Job.
Yes, yes.
I mean, Satan is almost like leaning over a fence, chatting with God, almost like their neighbors.
Oh, he's part of the heavenly court. He belongs there. That's his duty. Now, that got changed over time a little bit, but the original Jewish beliefs about Satan were that he was the avenging angel, and he could have access to God whenever he wanted.
Yeah. Yeah, much more in line with, really, the dragon type of beliefs I think you're describing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Eventually, that right to reconciliation got lost. The Yezidi, who have been in the news lately, too, they're a group of Kurdish Iraqis who are sometimes called, I think, not quite accurately, devil worshippers, because you have to define what you mean by the term devil. They have an angel they do worship called Melek Taus, who is the favorite of God. But he got into an argument, did something he wasn't supposed to, got sent into exile down to this planet. But their belief is that there will be a reconciliation. They're certain of that.
Interesting.
And that's an important concept, because you need these two forces. You need the energy of chaos and complexity, and you also need the energy of regulation and order, and they have to work together. If
you know,
they don't work together, the system collapses.
What about, boy, you're making my mind just bounce off of every wall here. What about Zoroastrianism?
Well, that's the Iranian version.
Right, this is like 6th century B.C., as I recall, something around that time?
Probably a little earlier, if you believe Aristotle.
Okay, but the principles of Zoroastrianism, let me see if I remember this correctly.
Yeah.
This is one of the, as I remember, the primordial expressions of a good versus evil theology.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in that system, good is expected to prevail over evil, although I don't know how certain it is, but they're kind of like almost equal or nearly equal in power, and that this whole thing is played out through time, and then at the end of time, good will
triumph. Yeah, 9,000 years. But it depends on what version of Zarathustrianism you're talking about. There is something called Zurvanism, which gives a little more power and a little more right of reconciliation to Ahriman in relation to Ahura Mazda.
Ahriman is the adversary, I assume?
Yeah, he's the opposer. He wakes up one day and sees this light coming into his kingdom. That's one version. In another version, the woman that Ahura Mazda had created gets rather taken with Ahriman and goes to join him in his realm. So you have some interesting stories there, and I'm not sure which is the most accurate. But the oldest of the Zendavestas wasn't quite as strict a division between all good and all evil. And if you read even the ones that try to make that division, it's not clear from his actions that Ahura Mazda is any better than Ahriman. In fact, he's probably more of a deceiver.
So this also sounds like almost straight dragon culture type of belief system.
Oh, that's the one split that went toward Iran from Yima's people. He was called Yima in the Zendavestas. He's called Yama in the Rig Vedas, but it's the same person.
It seems to me that, later Judaism and then Christianity and certainly Islam almost are refutations of the dragon culture, although the way that you're describing it, it's really not hard to see how they also originated from that.
Sure,
so really, what's the difference? They essentially, in Christianity, you get this, the elimination of this reconciliation.
Yeah.
I mean, Satan becomes the eternal adversary.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It always struck me as odd. I remember being 9 years old, having this great revelation as a 9-year old child, that telling my mother that, hey, you know, Mom, the ancient Greeks, we may call what they believed myth, but actually it was their religion. What makes us sure that we've got our religion correct?
When I was a young girl, I was walking home from the library one night, and I must have been in about fifth grade, and suddenly this question popped into my head. How can I know the difference between the Greek and Egyptian myths, which I like to read, and the Bible?
Yes, right.
I had no answer to it. I said, well, if I can't tell the difference, and then at the time I assumed, then they're both myths. But I think the other possibility is that they're both, although slightly garbled because of time and transmission, that they may both be accurate about certain things.
Right.
And then as I was driving one day to RIT, this other question popped into my mind, the reason I'm no longer driving there. You know, how could a being whose name means the bringer or bearer of light be the personification of evil? Now, the old texts are very good in cosmology because they'll tell you the answer to that, that light came from darkness, that without darkness there would be no light. And that, if you look at cutting-edge astrophysics, in fact, that's a better description of what our science is telling us about the few seconds after the Big Bang.
I'm not sure if I'm following you here. Sorry.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I get, you know, Lucifer, bringer of light, bearer of light.
Yeah, yeah.
And how does that relate to the Big Bang?
Well, in terms of what happened a few seconds after the Big Bang, there were no stars. There was no light. There was a kind of foggy, gray, cloudy liquid after that point.
Mm-hmm.
And then the first stars began to form themselves. And so you could read these texts if you were doing what the barbers call a stripping procedure.
Okay.
There is another hypothesis. You could read it as these are all easy to remember because we're personifying them, stories about astrophysics. So that Lucifer is the dark energy that creates light energy.
Enables light to exist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So although he's called the Dark Lord, that doesn't necessarily mean anything bad.
I understand.
And the Hindus are much better at that, but the Zendavesta also has that feature, or at least in some of the traditions it does. The problem, as Nietzsche saw it, was that Zarathustra had divided all sentient beings into either all good or all evil, and that was one of the biggest blunders that philosophy could ever make, which the older texts didn't make. I think the Rig Vedas are closer in some ways to this initial dragon culture than Zarathustrianism turned out to be.
Yeah, and in fact, I'm glad you mentioned them, because the Rig Vedas are indeed very ancient, I know this, and it's also had been argued that they themselves derived from a much earlier oral tradition, I think. Is that true? This goes back very, very...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the Rig Vedas themselves, I think, derived from like 3,500 years ago or 2000 BC, maybe that far back, perhaps?
I think they were written down, what I saw, 1500, but I may be wrong. The Mahabharata, I think, maybe. We know that...
Contemporaneous with even ancient Egyptian civilization, roughly speaking.
Yeah, but those are youngsters, in a sense. because if you've got statues of lion-headed man and of the constellation Orion at 40,000 BC, then that Paleolithic civilization had to be thinking about these things.
There's an archaeological find 40,000 years old of a lion-headed man?
Yes. Well, 38,000, but they've changed the carbon dating a little, so you're supposed to add a couple thousand, and I don't have the most up-to-date figure, but somewhere in that area.
That's an amazing find.
Oh, yes.
I mean, it's incredible. where was that one found?
In Ulm, Germany. And it looks, if you saw the statue of the god Zervon, the god of time, it's a Hellenistic statue.
It's 38,000 years old, and it's Hellenistic in style? Is that what you're saying?
There's similarities. Well, I mean, if you see the one... And
for people not aware, Hellenistic art, I mean, this is... When you think of classical Greek sculpture, the perfectly formed...
Well, no, it's not that good.
Okay,
but, you know, you can see the general, this is the lion-headed man. And it's missing the serpent that goes around the legs of the Hellenistic one. It's not standing on a globe, but it's for all the world, it's very much like Ion, god of time, in the older Zervon variety of Zarathustrianism.
So it's in Germany, which is also astonishing, though.
Huh?
I mean, the fact that it's in Germany is astonishing to me, because this is, by any conventional historical understanding, 38,000 years ago, Germany, there was no culture, supposedly. There was no civilization.
We shouldn't say that.
Well, I'm not saying there wasn't, but I think the conventional...
Yeah.
The conventional wisdom is that there was no advanced culture at all.
Now, our satellites are picking up sunken towns along the Baltic shoreline, and we know pretty much, I think from linguistic analysis and from archaeology, that the people of Asgard were likely to be in Siberia, and were the northern Eurasian culture.
Asgard being the kind of Norse myth where the gods lived.
Yeah, and where Odin, who was a warrior, lived. This was the capital of their Aesir civilization. They went west toward Scandinavia. He led them there because they and the Vanir to the south were in constant civil wars with each other, and finally he left to go west. And it wouldn't be unusual then to find his people in Ulm, Germany, and the ivory flute that they discovered at the same location. As I said, it has an eastern pentatonic scale instead of a western one.
And how old is the flute?
About 35,000.
Incredible.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is. I remember again as a child reading. I had a Time Life collection of books on the natural world. There was one on evolution, one on early humanity, and 35,000 years ago, you know, we were supposed to be just emerging as Cro-Magnon man. People remember that. With you know, just living in caves.
Yeah, but the caves had star charts in them, according to one article in Science Journal I had.
Amazing. I'm so blown away by what you're saying, and I'm sure that many listeners are thinking the same thing, because to have an advanced civilization being discovered in Northern Europe at the dates that you're talking, this throws out the window, really, so much conventional ancient history.
Yeah, and it should, in a sense, because the data are there. Someone called Eurasia the unknown continent, one of the geneticists that had been doing studies. We haven't really recognized our roots. We're not proud of them. And one of the other reasons I wrote this book is that I think we're in desperate need of a renaissance, that that without it, our civilization will collapse because we've lost contact, or it's been taken away from us, with our real roots and our real culture. And the rest of the world, I know when my son was in Kazakhstan, the museum people there were so thrilled and so surprised that he knew any of this, because they knew it, but they didn't think Westerners knew it. And they, you know, they took him on special tours, and they talked to him, and they were just so thrilled that he understood our ancient root culture. But that's a very sad story, because we all should understand it.
Well, you really have to wonder, because I spend most of my days, when I have time to think about the whole UFO cover-up, I mean, that's basically
mm-hmm.
my life,
mm-hmm.
recognizing how a transformation of truth on that issue can completely destabilize
mm-hmm.
existing structures of power.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, listening to you, I keep thinking of Napoleon's quote to the effect that religions are extremely useful to
mm-hmm.
control populations with. And really what you are suggesting in your research is
mm-hmm.
equally revolutionary,
well,
because it would upset religious truths, not simply Christian,
mm-hmm.
but Jewish and
mm-hmm.
Muslim. And
and yet at the same time, it would unite them. If they could all get back to their roots, they would understand themselves better.
Yeah.
That's the tragedy for them, that there's a loss in neglecting these major parts of their tradition. And the intolerance that arises from this separation is also not a good thing. Too many quite terrible things have happened in the world because of it. But you also remember with Napoleon that, well, there was another question that popped into my head. Why did Napoleon go to Egypt?
Indeed.
And,
why did he?
Well, the standard theory, I guess, was to cut off some kind of a supply line to the British Empire. But while he was there, he wasn't the military genius he normally was. He was busy having his men find the Rosetta Stone, of documenting Egyptian monuments that are now gone. If they hadn't drawn them and described them, we wouldn't even know that they had ever existed.
It was really the first systematic analysis, I think, of ancient Egyptian culture
mm-hmm.
by Western
mm-hmm.
Europeans.
And, of course, Napoleon, all of Napoleon's brothers were Freemasons. His generals were Freemasons. So one of my hypotheses would be maybe he went there to keep this tradition from getting completely lost, and the discovery of the Rosetta Stone before it got covered up by the silt of the Nile allowed us to interpret ancient languages. It allowed us to read the Zendavesta. Allowed us to discover the Sumerians. It just was a magnificent find.
Yeah.
It opened up new worlds.
Yeah, it's been argued that his trip to Egypt really was not militarily, that it didn't make sense on a military
mm-hmm.
basis.
No.
And then he bolted, of course, leaving his army behind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To fend for himself.
Yeah, which a good military strategist doesn't usually do.
Oh,
so
no.
There was something unusual about that whole event as well. My major question now on the present side of this timeline, I think I'm being fairly successful at getting it back to northern Eurasia on the oldest end of it, but at the present is where are the remnants of this dragon culture that are self-aware that that's what they are? Do they exist any longer? Or
indeed.
Have these organizations just been so busy being secret and trying to fit into society that they've lost their central purpose and their knowledge and information?
Do you suspect that they are around or not?
I'm not too optimistic about the Freemasons as carriers for this anymore. I don't know.
Interesting. Because there are books on Freemasonry that periodically come out. Some of them are pretty good. I've read one or two that argue that there is indeed a kind of aware higher level that the uppermost level Masons are tuned in to some of these.
But the organization itself is denying that, and it's trying to fit itself more and more into the Judeo-Christian tradition.
We have 1 minute to go. Do you realize we've gone through 2 hours?
No.
Incredible. I loved your book, but I have to say, I love talking with you even more. Because it's just, you can tell a great story, Colleen. And you do it so carefully. And the fact that we didn't even get into the whole political situation at Rochester Institute of Technology, but it is abysmal. And you did tell me that basically there were, I think, religious professors had problems with your book and really spearheaded it.
Well, one of them was part of the, what did they call it, a special group for religious studies. He was the one that instituted the campaign against me through email.
Are you still working legally to try to deal with this, or
no? That's
letting it go.
We have rights on paper, but the system is set up in such a way that the burden of proof is so high on the person bringing the complaint that, short of having a notary sign a statement of...
As an adjunct, you're not tenured at that institution.
You
really didn't have much recourse.
Yeah.
Well, you have books that can continue to tell the story. They can't stop you from doing that.
No. Well, people have a hard time shutting me up.
As I've learned, happily, let me just say, I've been the honored guest at your home a few times and had some really nice conversations, and I know we will in the future.
Yeah.
I'm so glad we had this interview. I guess that's going to have to be it for now.
Okay.
And we didn't even get to talk too much about Lucifer. A little bit, I'm glad.
Yeah.
But there's always so much more. But I guess that's going to have to be it for this week's interview. So let me just thank you, Colleen Clements, for being here.
You're welcome.
To everyone listening, you have been listening to Through the Keyhole. I'm Richard Dolan, hosting this week for my wife, Karen, who will be back again next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. You can, incidentally, come to our website. You can go to the ParanormalRadioNetwork.com site to listen to other shows that are on this station, as well as my wife's and my website, which is KeyholePublishing.com. That's KeyholePublishing.com, just like looking through a keyhole. Our guest this week has been Colleen Clements, and again, Colleen, thank you so very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
So long, everyone. Catch you next time.